Our thanks to Rollbar for once again sponsoring Does Not Compute. No matter what tech stack you choose, you're eventually going to have to deal with production errors. Finding and fixing those errors can be a huge time sink, but Rollbar makes it simple. Instead of having to rely on users to report issues and then dig through server logs trying to diagnose them, or flooding you with email errors, Rollbar can automatically alert you when new issues pop up. What's really great is that the alerts give you all the context you need to fix these issues fast. You can find stack traces, request parameters, which users an issue has affected, and more. Rollbar hooks into any major language or framework in just minutes, so you can get started tracking errors today. They also work with lots of the other tools you're probably already using and love, like Jira, GitHub, Trello, Slack, HipChat, Bitbucket, and others. Take a look at rollbar.com/DNC to learn more. When you sign up using that link, Rollbar will give you 1 month of their Bootstrap plan for free, usually $49 a month. Thanks again to Rollbar for their continued support of the show, and make sure to check out rollbar.com/DNC today. Sean, I'm mad.
At what?
I'm mad at my toaster oven, man.
So many things to be mad about.
Yeah, truly.
Your consumer toaster oven?
My consumer toaster oven.
I don't even have a toaster.
A toaster oven or a toaster or both?
Neither.
Interesting. So how do you toast?
Oh, I use a pizza stone in the oven. It takes a while, but it works very well.
Okay. Okay. I can see how that would be nice.
You slap it on the top.
You can use like a cast iron pan too. I've done that.
Yeah. I just slap it on the top rack and then put the what is it, the broiler? Yeah, I use the broiler.
Broiled toast.
My favorite. Broiled anything. Slap a piece up there.
So this toaster, it's a Cuisinart TOB-260N1. That's the model name. Great model name. Easily memorable.
easily searchable.
I recently bought it. And I know this is ridiculous, because why am I talking about a toaster? But this toaster is so bad that I want to make sure that no one buys this toaster. It has a bunch of reviews on Amazon, like I think 200 or 300 something reviews, 4.5 stars. Everything's supposed to be great. And it's a pretty pricey toaster. I mean, it's $250, right? It's not cheap.
That is expensive.
I really love a good toaster oven, though. And our last toaster oven finally gave out after years and years. And we didn't have one for a while. And I was like, I really miss it. And I want to have a nice toaster, because I use it all the time for like everything. Almost everything I eat gets cooked in a toaster oven. Mm. Fantastic. I love them. So I'm like, I'll spend the money. I'll spend the $250. So I buy this thing, and it arrives. It looks fine. It's visually looks good. It feels solid, right? Within a couple days, the labels on the front, like for the buttons, the start, stop, and change time and all that, start rubbing off.
It's the beginning of the end when that happens.
Like 3 days, strong.
That's crazy.
Three days. And the light button is just gone.
That's funny.
The plus 30 second button went a little bit later.
So you can't even really use it then.
Oh, I sharpied it back on.
Oh, the button still works, but the labels are gone.
The button is fine. It's just the label.
I see.
The paint rubbed off within a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. So now, I mean, we have no idea what any of the controls do, right? It's ridiculous. But I wish that was just it. The actual way that you control the entire toaster is with this rotary dial on the front. It's just like, you know, kind of like an infinite spinner, like you see on a stereo knob or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those usually click, indicating when the setting changes. Like it, you feel a little tick every time the volume changes in your car stereo, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But this one, you feel the click, but it doesn't actually align to the menu screen changing. So you're trying to scroll through a menu, and every time it clicks, it will go either 0 or 1, and then sometimes it will change halfway in between a click, so you have to like hold it in between two click states. It's incredibly awkward, and it makes it just like almost impossible to use and navigate.
You have to hold it there?
Yeah. It won't.
That's crazy.
So you can click it, it'll be on 1 in the right position, and then when you click it down, it'll skip down 2 or 0 or 1. And so sometimes you have to hold it in between two click states instead of just letting it, like you would turn it naturally, you know?
Right. That would be frustrating. I feel like there's a lesson there to be, or there's a parallel here to the modern web. In a lot of these fancy new sites don't really seem to work very well.
Oh man, it's absurd. On the day of the keynote last week, I installed iOS 11 as we discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Keynote 2 weeks ago, I don't know. The keynote a while back.
the latest one.
I installed iOS 11 and I went to the iMac Pro page, I believe it was,
mm-hmm.
on my iPhone 7 Plus, the latest and greatest currently available iPhone. And I load this page up and it crashed Safari. It crashed Safari and you can barely even scroll through it. Actually, pull it up on your phone. I'm kind of curious.
I'm kind of scared to do this. I saw this specific page getting a lot of heat on Twitter, mostly from designers though, because they were like, did they take like 5 minutes before the show and slap this together?
Right.
iPad Pro Apple. Let's see what happens. I went back on my word and I did in fact install iOS 11. It happened.
I knew it. How are you liking it so far?
It's really nice. It's just kind of slow. The first couple of betas are usually kind of slow. Did I just say I'm looking for the iPad Pro? I meant the iMac Pro. But yeah, no, it's good. I really like the Control Center stuff. It's really great on the iPad. So I put it on my iPad Pro and I'm really enjoying the dock specifically. It's pretty nice.
Yeah, the iPad version seems really great. I feel like every year though, or maybe every other year, there's a big announcement about the iPad. It's like a new form factor. The iPad Mini I was really excited about. The iPad Pro I was really excited about. Or a big OS upgrade in this case, where I'm like, yeah, I want to get back into the iPad. I want to be an iPad person, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I get an iPad a few months later, and then I end up never using it, and I sell it. Like 6 months after that.
Right. I remember when
you got...
happens
every time. Yeah. And I mean, I'm really hopeful because I do want to be an iPad person, you know?
I draw on it a lot. I use the pencil quite a bit.
Interesting.
Especially when I'm trying to think about... So I just did a bunch of redesigning. So the shipping stuff, I think I talked about it last time. I'm actually ready to ship it or ship the shipping stuff tonight. During low traffic time. So I had to redesign a bunch of the receipts and the order views and stuff because the data is grouped differently. And I wasn't really a huge fan of how they were set up before. So I sketched them all out on the iPad and then I just shared it to Slack and I said, hey, what do you guys think? How do you think this looks? And it's kind of dumb. I mean, because I could draw on a piece of paper and take a picture of it and send it, but this was just easier, you know? You just click a button and it drops it into Slack and then everyone gives me feedback. And then using the pencil, I can just, you know, it's just easy to redraw stuff. Because I like to draw with pens, but obviously you can't erase pen from a paper. So it just worked really well. So I use it a lot for drawing and kind of thinking visually or just kind of like wireframing things that I'm working on, UI pieces. And a lot of times I'll kind of draw flowcharts too if I'm thinking through, especially on the Rails side when I'm thinking through classes, when I'm like not sure what to call something or not sure how things should be connected. I'll draw little ERD diagrams of my classes on it.
Are you just doing all this stuff freehand or are you using an app for it? Or?
Well, I've used Notes, which works pretty well. I use Bear currently because Bear just updated with Apple Pencil support. And I do all my note-taking in Bear anyway. So that's just what I'm using for that.
How long have you been using Bear? I've looked at it a couple times, but I've never actually like made the plunge.
Six months or so.
Yeah, you really like it?
It feels like an upgraded version of NVL, which I really like.
Really, really? Okay. I'll have to take another look at that, I guess.
It feels like a fancier version of NVL. So like, there's a really powerful tagging feature in Bear that's not really advertised quite a bit. You can actually have I'm pretty sure you can have multi-level taxonomy as well. So you can tags within tags and such. And it's pretty easy. I mean, you just write in Markdown and it formats everything for you and you can export to Markdown, PDF, you can export to Docs, all that stuff, export to HTML. It supports drawing with Apple Pencil. It's just fast and it just works. And the syncing, it just works as well. I haven't had any issues with it, so I just stick with it.
Yeah, this looks really nice. The design for the editing tools and export sheets. I'm looking at the marketing site right now.
Yeah.
It's really beautiful.
Yeah, it's great.
This is just really nicely designed. It's very pleasant.
The color schemes are super nice. which is kind of like, you know, I mean, that's kind of secondary to functionality, but it has a bunch of different color schemes.
Design
you can
first.
Use. Design first, yeah. What's really cool is that you can, even on Mac, you can match the app icon to the theme that you have currently set, which is kind of feels kind of fancy. what else? Editor. It just works. I'm paying for Pro because I thought I liked it enough, and I use it on my iPad and my phone as well.
Wait, you're paying for Pro? It's what? It's a subscription thing?
There, it's not. It doesn't have to have a subscription. There's, you get a couple of things if you subscribe. I can't remember what they are.
Okay, I found it. It looks like okay. So device sync. I would definitely need to get that then. Application themes and exporting.
Yeah, yeah. So okay. Exporting.
I mean, this is $1.50 a month though. $15 a year. Like that's pretty reasonable for something as important as a notes app.
I use it every day too. So
yeah, oh yeah, man.
And the cool thing is that it has a, you can create, there's a global shortcut, so you can create notes just with one shortcut, which is
great. Very NVAlt.
Yeah, it's very NVAlt, right? It's fast as crap too. And I remember, I think I was listening to the show Due by Friday, and I think Alex Cox says she uses it and she has thousands of notes in it and it's fine. Even to the point Merlin Mann was like, really? It works. Like it just works. Because when she says it works, it must you know, just work. And he was kind of skeptical, but she was kind of swearing by it. So
here's the only issue though, is I moved from NVAlt to just notes.app because I just wanted something that was always there on all my devices and just worked, and notes.app actually does that now.
Right.
So I did that like probably a year and a half or 2 years ago. And
yeah, that sucks.
It sucked because I couldn't really move everything over. I had to move stuff manually in a lot of cases. And now I feel like I'm going to be getting to that same thing where I have all this stuff in notes. How many notes do I have in here? It doesn't even show a count of how many notes you have.
Yeah.
So
the sole reason I don't use Apple Notes, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think it does taxonomies, does it?
No, it doesn't. I just search for everything. That's how I've always found all my notes. That's how I used NVAlt as well.
Sure.
So I don't really tag stuff in that way. I just write content that I know I will be familiar with searching for later, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I just put the taxonomy in the body, I suppose, is what I'm doing there. But it's just a bummer because I don't think there's any way to really export from notes except for clicking on your notes and copying and pasting.
Yeah, that would take it'd be very frustrating.
It looks like you can export an individual note as a PDF, which is not really.
Yeah, that'd be terrible.
I don't know. Maybe there's a way to AppleScript it or something. I'll have to look at that. Oh, God.
But I like it. It works. Circling back to this iPad Pro site, my phone has heated up considerably. It's very warm.
Can you scroll?
Yeah.
Can you scroll? The scrolling was real janky for me.
Yeah, I can scroll. The scroll's not janky, so their fancy like parallax effects are not working very well. So, for example, if you scroll down enough, you start to get to this terrible view where 8/10 or 18 core Xeon processor slides on top of the iMac in the background. First of all, that looks terrible. Second of all, it's just straight white text over an image, which is kind of silly. But as you scroll down, it like chunks because the background image on the iMac Pro changes as you scroll, and it's not smooth at all.
Look, man, I think you're being a little bit harsh on that page. I'm sure it took a lot of courage.
This seems uncharacteristically bad for Apple site. Usually Apple site is really, really nice, right? Like I really like the interactions, but this seems weird to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely not their best work. There's another one, of like the announcement sites that I was kind of,
Seems hastily prepared. That's what it seems like to
me.
Yeah.
Right.
Someone looked at it and was like, good enough, you know,
although, I mean, at the same time, I've on apple.com for like months now. The header has had bugs for me in Chrome, like visual artifacts.
Really?
So, yeah. So I don't know. Like, I don't know how much Apple cares about their website.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't go to it that often, to be honest.
I go to it and then I regret it.
Yeah.
That shopping cart fills up real fast, huh?
Yeah. Maybe it's good that I don't do that because I would. You know me and how I talk myself into things.
You?
Yeah. Yeah. Bear's great. I like it. It works for me. It's been working for me. It took over Dropbox Paper. I don't use that anymore.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Yeah.
Does it have like sharing, like any sort of sharing or publishing features built in?
I don't think there's any sharing features.
Okay.
That I'm not like collaboration stuff.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess if I had to do that, I would use notes anyway.
Okay, so just before we started recording, you were starting to tell me about, you said it looks like you're finally going to get your chance here pretty soon dedicate your time to switching over to Elixir.
Yes. So I've been working on it off and on when I have some downtime, and you know, everyone on the team is on board for various, you know, we've talked about it, like what are the advantages of staying on our current platform and what are the advantages of moving to the new platform, and everyone kind of decided, yeah, let's do it. So I've been working on it here and there, but with the current design collective, there's been a few features that have been outstanding that are, they're just kind of like things that need to exist in the app. They're kind of like baseline features that everyone expect. And so what I've been doing for the past couple of weeks, I've been 100% Rails for 2 weeks, and I'm just finishing up. I think I have another week left maybe on a couple of these features, one being the shipping updates. And then at that point, we've all kind of agreed that once these things are deployed and live, we're kind of at a spot where we're ready to sit and collect numbers and, you know, really like check out our analytics, really check out the various numbers that we have, our data and stuff like that. And then, you know, we talked about it and my boss was like, okay, well, I think, and she, this was her idea, not mine. She was like, I think that after these features go out, I think that you take two and a half, maybe 3 months and work full time on the new platform. And
that's awesome, man. That's so good to hear.
Yeah. If I weren't in public, I would have laid on the floor and cried a little bit. But I was outside in public. And yeah, so it's really cool. It's really cool to have a team that's like on board and thinking like, you know, they understand the reasons why, and they understand that it takes time, and they understand that there needs to be like a feature freeze, and everyone's on board, which is really cool. I think everyone's kind of hitting their stride, which feels good too. I know that Scott's onboarding like 8 stores a week, which I didn't know that was happening, which is kind of cool because that means I'm not like, there's not bugs, there's not problems happening where they're like, oh, this doesn't work. They're just doing their stuff, which was kind of cool, you know?
Right.
It feels good to have things just working. And so he doesn't have to reach out to me like, hey, I'm about to go over to the store. Do you want to check on this thing? He's like onboarding 8 to 10 stores a week.
That's very cool. And so when a store is onboarded there, I mean, they obviously sign up and set up like whatever bank account info and shipping info and all that kind of stuff. And then they add their products and schedule a sale. Do I have that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. So there's other things like they have to sign our marketplace agreement, it's just like terms of service stuff and
Meta things.
Yeah, and we have an OAuth flow with Stripe. So in adding their bank account, basically they sign up for a Stripe account because we're using Stripe Connect, which is great, by the way. So they go through and they just kind of sign our agreement, which is also an all OAuth flow with DocuSign too. I can talk about that at some point. That was kind of cool how it works out. But it's all automated. So our salespeople don't have to do anything really. They just say, all right, here's the onboarding. And one of our people will be there in the store with them, kind of walking them through it. But the store can do all this stuff on their own. So there's not any actual like physical paperwork that changes hands. It's all kind of done behind the scenes, which is cool. Yeah. So they'll go through the flow and, you know, after the initial, like them creating their store and filling up bank account and stuff like that, Scott will walk them through. Part of the onboarding is they add a couple of products. Scott will walk them through that. And then he takes off and they're kind of on their own adding inventory. And then our customer rep reaches out like once a week saying, you know, obviously we can see how many products they're adding and things like that. They'll just say, like, do you need help? How's things going? And then Mikey, our customer service rep or store rep, will reach out and kind of like plan with them when they want to launch their first sale and stuff like that. So usually what happens is a store gets approved, which puts them on the marketplace. And then we have a thing called a feature called Announce. So after they're approved and everything checks out, you click Announce, and that kind of sends a notification to their existing customer base saying, hey, we've launched an online store. And then after that, their sale will start.
So one of the things that I know you were really excited about with getting the Elixir stuff done is, I'm not sure with what the right terminology is around this, so you'll have to enlighten me, I guess. Mm-hmm. But you were talking about basically what sounded like, I think you called it umbrella apps.
Yep. Yeah. That's just the term
It's like multi-tenant, basically.
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just, it's like you have a global namespace, and then you can have multiple app namespaces underneath. I'm not sure how to do it in Rails, but that's how it's done in Elixir. So we have a couple other app ideas that will run parallel in tandem with DK and kind of supplement, which they don't really, they shouldn't be part of the DK code base or the actual DK namespace because they don't really fit there, but they're close enough that they should be able to share data through some sort of public API. Now I could spin up another Rails app and then have the two Rails apps talk to each other that way. But Elixir has this thing called umbrella applications. So you have your base app namespace, and then you can basically have as many sub applications inside of that main umbrella app. So you have your main OTP process, which is when you start the server up, OTP starts up and it starts all the supervisors, and that's kind of what does all the things, quote unquote. But they all kind of run on the same OTP process, but they all have separate namespaces. They all have separate domains. The new, especially Phoenix 1.3, is really big on domain-driven design. I'm a really big fan of that idea.
When you're doing this thing where you have this multiple app namespace thing going on, what is handling actual like incoming HTTP request routing and that sort of thing? Like, is what layer is that happening at?
That's the Phoenix layer.
Okay, so you basically just tell Phoenix, I have this app that starts here and this app that starts here.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, here's the namespace for each app that is running and where it needs to be accessed and all their configuration information.
Exactly.
Right?
So if you're thinking in terms of a Rails app, you would have multiple app folders.
Right.
So you might have an app folder for DK and you might have an app folder for DK2 or whatever. And then each app folder has its own routes definition.
DK vertical integration.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so the thing with Phoenix 1.3 is that the actual business logic is not even so there. So for Phoenix 1.2, similar to the Rails app folder, there's a folder called web, and that's where people were putting everything, models, etc. Everything goes in there. Phoenix 1.3, they're trying to encourage separation of concerns in how you're actually building your application. So instead of throwing all your business logic in the same folder as your web controllers and your routes, they split it out. So you have your app folder, which would be like your umbrella app. So each folder has like its own, each app has its own folder, essentially, like its root folder. And then you have a lib folder, which, I mean, traditionally, that's where all your business logic would go. I mean, that's like if you're building a library or something, that's where all the logic goes. That's where the application goes, is inside a lib. And then next to that, there's a web folder, which is where the router and the controllers go. So what happens is your application actually is separated from your web stuff. And you essentially, your lib folder, you build a public API that your web folder accesses. So you might have like a namespace like accounts, account.getUser, and then you would only access data, like user data, through that base namespace for that. So it's like separating the business logic from actually serving the data because they're kind of separate concerns.
So Phoenix is often compared to Rails.
Mm-hmm.
But from a lot of the stuff that you said, it sounds like it might be closer to something like what an Express or a Sinatra does for you.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, Phoenix.
That's interesting. I don't understand that comparison.
Well, there's a lot of people, like, so it was kind of popular to say like, oh, Phoenix is the new Rails. And what's funny is that a lot of the people that were coming from like Erlang and Elixir were like, I don't get it. It's not like that.
And it doesn't seem anything like Rails.
It's not really. And that's part of that stigma is the reason for some of the big changes in Phoenix 1.3.
Right.
Because
that makes a lot of sense.
The web folder being like the Rails app folder, you put everything in app, everything goes in there. A lot of the apps they were seeing were like their people were just putting tons of code, so like your controller would do way too much stuff.
Turns out,
and so what they did was they're like, okay, we're gonna stop encouraging this, and we're gonna split it out. So it makes it a little harder. Like the learning curve gets a little bit more difficult because now you have to you can't just throw something together. You have to plan out your domains. You have to plan your application out. You can't just have everything in one folder that magically ties it all together. So some people kind of complain about that, but I think it's really good because it encourages you to think in terms of domains and think in terms of separation of concerns. You know, your controllers for sending data to the user don't really, they should not really be tied in with your business logic, your schemas and
right.
stuff like that. And so now they're not. And what is really cool is that some of the features or some of the apps that we're planning on for DK in the future, this kind of like plays in really well with that kind of setup. And then on top of it,
man, you got me jealous. I just really want to, I want to play with this stuff.
You want
so
a job,
bad.
Paul? You want a job?
Oh man, I have too many jobs right now already.
Well, on top of all that, and I think I was talking too, like you can't do some of the stuff with Heroku because like you can't expect a Heroku VM to be around for a long time because when you restart it, it goes away and the new one comes up. But there, so like with OTP, and especially this is especially cool with umbrella applications. With OTP, there's like release phases, so you can actually have when you release a new version of your application. You don't even have to restart your processes. As soon as a new connection comes in, it'll hot swap the code and they'll get the new version.
Nice, nice. Does that, you said that doesn't work with Heroku?
I don't believe it works for Heroku. I think you need a container.
Because Heroku it's going to redeploy the whole slug.
It's going to restart it all, yep.
And then kick the server over.
Right,
yeah.
But there's a lot of things you get for free.
Sorry, the dinos.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like there's a lot of things you get for free on the platform because of that. Like, I think we were talking about real time. Maybe this was in a chat, but we were talking about real time. And then you asked me like, how would different instances know, how is there a shared state there?
Right.
Yeah.
Cause like in the Rails world, you use something like Redis.
Right.
In order to communicate that sort of data.
Yeah. So, there's a specific feature called presence in Phoenix. And I have to read up on it more. I haven't tried to use it yet. There's some things I'm going to be using it for coming up from Watch Nature. But essentially, you also get that for free without having to use an external dependency like Redis. What's interesting is that Erlang has its own Redis-style storage built into it. I think there's one called Amnesia, which is basically an ephemeral database. And there's one called Term, I think. I could be totally wrong on that one. I'll have to put it in the show notes. But last I read about it, basically it is like a Redis-like data structure where you can store whatever you want. And then because of how OTP is set up, because your applications are running on the same base layer, you can share your data that way. You have a shared state that way. So you could then do real-time between both of your applications and also have a shared state between them.
I still don't understand. I understand how that shares data between processes or applications running on the same machine, but I still don't understand how that, like, if you, for example, had two dinos on Heroku.
Yeah.
I don't understand how the data would be shared between those two dinos. I think you would still need something external, right? Like a Redis, a separate server for that.
Yeah, I have to read up on it again because I didn't ask myself that specific question. Like, how would you do it across different machines? But I know that there's a thing, quote unquote, for it to make it work, which is kind of crazy.
Well, let's talk about that next episode, definitely, because I would like to know more about that. That sounds very, very interesting.
Yeah, I should probably know more about what I'm talking about when it comes to that stuff, especially if people are listening to me talk about it. But I'm really enjoying the Elixir ecosystem, and I'm really glad that you brought up, like, that doesn't sound like Rails at all, because it's not. It's more like having multiple Express or Sinatra apps than having one larger Rails app.
The monolith is dead. Long live the monolith.
Well, it's kind of a monolith, right? It's an umbrella. Long live umbrellas.
Well, until it gets too windy.
Right, and then it falls upside down.
Today's episode of Does Not Compute was sponsored by Rollbar. Rollbar makes it simple to find and fix production issues by alerting you with the context you need to solve errors quickly. It integrates with just about every language and framework and plays nicely with lots of the other tools you already love, like Slack and GitHub. Check out rollbar.com/DNC today to get 1 month free of their Bootstrap plan. Thanks, Rollbar.